Good morning, everybody. Today is Monday, March 23rd, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Good morning, everyone. Happy Monday. It is beautiful blue sky and sunny here in upstate New York. And I spent my weekend going crazy doing spring cleaning. I don't know. It's just one of those things that happens to me. As soon as I start to feel like I'm coming out from under the Arctic blanket, I get very excited and I get all kinds of energy. So I clean this weekend and house looks great. I mean, you look around and it's like, wow, it almost looks like a different house just because everything is put away and neat again, like it's supposed to be, and shiny. I even took down the big insulated drapes on the back windows and put the they're not semi-transparent, but the sunlight can pass through the drapes. So at sunset, it was nice and sunny in the living room. But I get up this morning, and there's some sunshine shining in. I can hear some birds tweeting outside. Tweet, tweet, tweet. I get my coffee. I'm like, yay, it's spring. So as I'm getting ready to come down, I grab my phone to be able to check the temperature so I could give you my daily report for the temperature in upstate New York. And here I figured, I don't know, it looked like it was probably almost 50 degrees outside. Do you know it's only 17 degrees? Come on. It's March 23rd. 17 degrees. That's unacceptable. I'm putting a call out to Mother Nature to get down here and fix the problem. All right. I just had to share that with you. 17 degrees. Like, I was getting ready to go open the back door and let some fresh air. And I was like, oh, what? It looks like it's got to be 50, maybe 60 if we're lucky. No, 17. It was very deceptive. All right. So on Friday, actually last week, we did a whole bunch of interesting things. Don't ask me to name all the topics because I don't know. They come in one ear and they go out the other. But the title of Friday's show was The Blood-Brain Barrier, Smart Dust, Kurzweil, and DARPA. So if that jogs anyone's memory as to what we talked about, it was a pretty good show. We dug into some of the things that they can do with smart dust and places that brain nanotechnology can go. And that Freitas had talked about non-damaging brain nanobots the day before. So I don't know if I'm going to go down that path today. I do have some stuff on the brain. I do have some research that I did. But I wanted to go back a little bit to the microbiome, because we had had a whole bunch of stuff that we had been talking about, and then we got distracted. So I came across a whole bunch of stories, though, that I wanted to share. And then at the end, I do actually have something about the brain. So we'll go back there. But here was one. So you know how we've been talking about glyphosate? And we determined in our research that glyphosate is, and this was according to Dr. Huber, a very potent antibiotic. And being a very potent antibiotic, glyphosate, a.k.a. Roundup, Monsanto, Roundup, is very good at killing bacteria. And you're going to think, well, that's good, right? Kill bacteria. Well, not all bacteria is bad, which, you know, we didn't understand that back in the 70s and 80s. We do now. Bacteria bacterial colonies live within our body and work in a symbiosis like in our gut with our gut flora. And we've also discovered with science that much of the flora in our gut is responsible for not only proper digestion of our food, but also a healthy immune system. And if you dig a little bit deeper now, we had read a story a few days back about your gut controlling your brain. And there is a nerve. We read a story, talked about the vagus. I always want to call it the vagus nerve, the vagus nerve. There's a direct connect between your gut and your brain. And some of the experiments that they have been doing shows that your gut flora has a big effect over you as an organism. And I'm sure we're going to find out a lot more as they dig more into the science of things. But just know that bacteria isn't always bad. And the stuff within your body is actually your first line of defense. I mean, when that gets damaged by antibiotics or eating Monsanto foods or whatever else you do that happens to damage that gut flora, it's going to cause you major issues. And we talked about some of those with the leaky gut syndrome and the inability to digest proper proteins. And, you know, actually, I saw too, there was another study that it wasn't only proteins, but it was proteins and carbohydrates. And, you know, as we dig more and more into the biology of things, at least for me, I know I'm reading all of these scientific studies, I'm starting to see a lot of connections between, and I mean, we've already known this with health issues and things that in our environment that are affecting us, but it's all related. It absolutely is all related. The general sickness of the population is absolutely related to what is being consumed. And for anyone, I just saw, by the way, let me pop over here quick, that GMO apple that they approved here in the United States for all of our Canadian listeners, and I know we have quite a few. It has also been approved in Canada. Canada has stepped right into line and decided to put their population up as a sacrificial guinea pig as well. Arctic apple, that's what it is. And they don't have to label it. So beware. It is called, and it is a registered trademark, Arctic, with a big R with a circle around it, apples. All right, let's get back to the story now. Hold on. I have lots and lots and lots of tabs open. This weekend was insane. I was juggling a lot. All right. Here we go. New drugs. So I thought the story was pretty interesting, and we'll use this as a jump-off point. New drugs may come from microbes in our gut. The microbes that live in our gut could provide a fertile source for antibiotics and other useful drugs. Now, we talked about, though, doing with the microbiome and passing bacteria between organisms. And in one of the stories that we read, and I think this was last week, in one of the stories that we had read, they had discovered that using bacteria out of one organism and putting it into another actually literally changed the personality of the person who got the transplanted bacteria, as in like those poop transplants we had talked about that they were doing for people with severe, and I don't even remember what the name of that what the name of that disorder was, but some people get it really bad after they take antibiotics, and they just have like forever diarrhea, and they can never get their gut bacteria back to where it's supposed to be. So they've been doing these fecal transplants, they call them. But in the story we were reading last week, it was saying that not in that particular case, but in some of the other cases where they were doing these experiments with bacterial transplants, that it was literally changing the personality of the person, or of the, actually it was a mouse, I believe, the mouse that they had swapped the bacteria out from and replaced it. All right, anyway, let's read some of this. One third of the drugs used in the clinic today were synthesized not by chemists or biologists, but by plants or microorganisms. Most of these, quote, natural products, unquote, come from a few genera of soil and marine bacteria that have long been known for their prolific chemistry. In addition to antibiotics, this group includes compactin, the grandfather of the entire drug class of statins, which Japanese microbiologists cultured for mold in rice sampled from a grain shop in Kyoto. Sirolimus, an immunosuppressant used to prevent organ rejection following transplants, which Brazilian scientists uncovered in soil samples from Easter Island. Oh, I didn't know about that. And doxorubicin, a widely used anti-cancer drug, which Italian researchers isolated from soil that surrounded Castel di Monte, a 13th-century castle. The classical process of drug discovery from microorganisms suffers from two challenges. One, it's slow. Microbial isolates are painstakingly cultivated and tested by one. Wow, this is a hard article to read at 12 minutes after 10 in the morning. It's not flowing very easily. It's like this guy's writing to sound smart, it almost feels like. So it's not flowing well. Normally, I can read these stories and make them sound interesting, even if they're boring, but I can't even. It sounds boring and it is boring. Well, let's cut to the chase. It says recent advances have raised the prospect of a resurgence in natural product discovery, albeit from an unanticipated source. Our lab has developed a new algorithm to scan bacterial genome sequences for drug-producing genes. Actually, I did have a story on that whole tool that they've been using. That's been going on for a while. They're also using that tool to scan their entire database of drugs, to identify off-label uses for drugs. And we learned about off-label use if you listen to the show back from 2 or 3 months ago. April Inverstein ran with the Confessions of a, I think it was called Confessions of a Big Pharma Drug Pusher or something like that. The woman that wrote that book was on. It was a great episode, but they had talked about how a lot of these drug companies are doing these off-label usages for these drugs that were never approved for a certain type of treatment, but they're doing it anyway. And you know, you can have all kinds of issues that way because there was never any testing. I mean, you are the guinea pig when you take the off-label, when you use the drug for off-label use. But all right, so let's see if we can finish this boring story and get into something that's more exciting for a Monday morning. Well, you know what? Mondays always suck anyway, so it's fine. I've only had like a quarter of a cup of coffee. I'm very tired today. Too much cleaning and exposure to dust. Oh my God, I dosed myself. All right, let's go. Blah blah blah. This tool. Yum 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 yum. It accelerates the process of natural product discovery by making it possible to perform the hardest steps on the computer, prioritizing bacterial species and even specific gene clusters that are more likely to encode. Oh my God, this story is so boring. All right, never mind. I'm gonna kill it. It was just too much for me in the morning. Nope. Can't be doing that one. That was nowhere near as fun as I was expecting. All right, let's do this one. So we've been talking about the microbiome and being able to pass some of that on to another organism, right? We talked about that a few days ago. Well, here's something interesting. And we've heard this. I mean, I know I've heard this about dogs, where dog spit actually has a natural antibiotic in it. And we had dogs growing up, and I did not like doggy kisses. Ew. Kitty kisses. I don't know. My cat, my little cat Simon, he loves to like climb up on the bed and he looks me right in the face. And then when I open my eyes, he'll give me like a little lick on the end of the nose. But I don't know. Kitties and doggies. Clean themselves well. So I don't know if I want too many. But kitties, from what I understand, cats do not have the antibiotic properties of their spit. So probably don't want cats cleaning you too much. Anyway, here we go. Scientists are investigating if living with a dog improves your microbiome. Is your dog having a probiotic effect on you? Scientists in the U.S. are recruiting volunteers, so anyone out there with a doggy who wants to become part of the study, to help them investigate the health benefits of living with a dog. Specifically, are the microorganisms that they share with you having a positive effect on your mental and physical health? Well, we've co-evolved with dogs over the millennium, but nobody really understands what it is about this dog-human relationship that makes us feel good about being around dogs, says lead researcher and anthropologist Kim Kelly from the University of Arizona in a press release. And you know what's interesting that I was just thinking of? So she's saying they don't know what it is that makes us feel good about dogs. Well, if we go back to that story about the Russian researcher that was certain that somehow his cat was brainwashing him to do his bidding, and in all of his years of research, that's what he did discover, toxoplasmas, which you get from cat turds in the litter box, actually invades our brains and turns us into suggestible vessels for the cat. I mean, there's definitely scientific evidence behind that, that the cat's microbes have evolved to, what's the word I'm thinking of, assimilate the host. To make them, you know, so we're looking through them at rosy cat goggles now. Oh, kitty, you ripping apart my couch is so cute, you know. So it's conceivable that the same thing has happened with dog spit or something that's gone and given us doggy goggles. See, I wasn't bitten by doggy goggles. I'm a cat person. But I wonder if that's why. Well, let's read on. Here it says, the question is, has the relationship between dogs and humans gotten under our skin? And we believe that it has. The hypothesis is based on research that has found that dogs and their owners grow to share the same types of gut bacteria after living with each other for some time. Now that is extremely interesting. Because a healthy population of microorganisms is essential to physical and mental health, particularly in later life, the team wants to figure out if dogs are unwittingly helping their owners achieve this. There is also epidemiological work showing that when young children and infants are in frequent contact with dogs, they have a reduced risk of developing immune disorders such as asthma and various types of common allergies, which could also be linked to microbe sharing. Who, I mean, this is pretty amazing. We're just learning about all this now, but there is like, and we've talked about it. I mean, I've mentioned this many times about how we're killing nature and the ecosystem, but I mean, even the fungus on the floor of the forest is the largest communication network on the planet. Did you know that? And they all tie together. We share. I was just seeing something the other day where some of the, and I don't even know what it was, if they were proteins. I don't know. It's too early and it's Monday. But we were either just watching something or I was watching a lecture where they were talking about the different classes of living organisms, and now they're thinking that they aren't as different and as unconnected as they originally thought, which of course, I mean, everything in science is wrong. Just remember that. The only thing that we know is what we can see today with our glasses off and bad focus. But as days go on, time goes on, and we become more advanced, and we start to turn the focus up, right? They always learn more. And we find out that probably our beliefs beforehand were probably kind of off. So anyway, all right, let's read a little bit more. The hypothesis is based on previous research that has found that dogs and their owners grow to share the same type of gut bacteria after living with each other for some time. Because a healthy population of microorganisms is essential to physical and mental health, particularly in later life, the team wants to figure out if dogs are unwittingly helping their owners achieve this. There's also epidemiological work that shows, oh, I read all this. So what? That shows when young children and Infants are in frequent contact with dogs. They have a reduced risk of developing immune disorders such as asthma and various types of common allergies, which can also be linked to microbe sharing. Kelly's team are now looking for volunteers with dogs to be studied over a 3-month period during which their gut bacteria, diet, physical activity levels, and immune functions will be assessed. Hey, maybe she's cute, guys. Each dog will have its physical activity levels and gut bacteria analyzed at the same time. Oh, you got to be 50 years or older. Volunteers must be strictly 50 years or older, healthy, have not taken antibiotics in the past 6 months, or lived with a dog. So I guess you can't have a dog right now. This means they're essentially starting from scratch. So any effects of their new dog pals have over the next 3 months should be easy to spot. And the team chose to work with older participants because research has shown that in people over 65, poor microbiome could mean death. So it is important to figure out all the means available to ensure good microbiome health in this age group. Follow-up evaluations will take place after 1, 2, and 3 months to look for any positive impacts on the gut microflora in either humans or dogs. And researchers will also note any changes in the mental health and emotional well-being in both the humans and the animals. Well, I'm going to tell you right there, I think we also dug into that, your emotional well-being with a good gut flora. And I'll tell you right away, when I take my probiotics, there's just an absolute difference in the way I see the world. So I emphatically agree that there's a connection there. And it is not psychosomatic. Absolutely not. I've spent many years trying to decode how to make myself feel better. And probiotics are a big, big part of all that. The team will try to figure out if the presence of a dog and the sharing of its microbiome actively encourages the growth of more positive microorganisms in their owner's gut so significantly that it could have a marked effect on their physical and mental health. Well, there you go. I mean, if they can discover that little doggies make you happy and healthy, especially over 50, I think we should all get cute little foofy dogs. I know some people like big dogs. We had a Siberian Husky and a poodle growing up. I love my Husky, but he was such a big dog, and big dogs need lots of loving. And it's hard. It really is hard. You know, they want to run, run, run. At least, you know, the poodle was small. My friend has the most adorable little dog. I don't even know what it is. It's like part Chihuahua and part Pomeranian or something. So it's this little cute yappy fluffy puffball the size of a cat, and he's the cutest little puppy ever. He really is. I mean, I think a little foofy dog, you know, ankle biter, so I wouldn't be doing any type of protecting as the SWAT team sees a footprint on the bucket in your backyard and decides to hop in your window just to make sure you're okay at 3 a.m. But it definitely would make a lot of noise if it heard something. They're pretty cute too, that little bandit. Bandit is the cutest little yippy dog I've ever seen. Anyway, we essentially want to find out, she says, is a dog acting like yogurt and having a probiotic effect? Ew. We can't wait to see the results. When you think about it, the idea that dogs being our best friends in many ways, and they aren't even aware that it is pretty special. So there you go. I'll drop that one into chat because I know we have a lot of dog lovers that listen to UCY. I thought of all of you when I saw that story. If my computer even works there. There you go. All right. So we're going to go back here because I had a couple other stories on the microbiome. Let's just get me to the right page, though. I saw the other day they're doing some pretty insane stuff. I mean, we, again, it's such a double-edged sword when you look at some of the developments that they're making and understanding the human body and understanding how everything ties together, you're like, holy shit, maybe I'll get to live to 100. But then when, you know, you, and we've talked about this, right? There's always the psychopaths that are steering the ship somewhere. So it's not that the technology and these scientific developments aren't good, because they are, but it's what they're planning on doing with them eventually, and how far this is going to go. And I don't trust half of the people who are in charge, and I don't think that this is being done necessarily for the good of the people, for you to live to be, you know, 500 years old. At least not for you and me. Like I've said before, this is us being guinea pigs for them to live to be 500 years old. All right. Well, I'm not seeing that down here. So hold on. Let's scroll back. Oh, here it is. Hold it. Let's get there. Well, damn it. I don't know. It's Monday morning. I do hear birds tweeting. I've been hearing geese flying over at all hours of the morning, by the way, and in huge droves. So that's good. That means that spring is finally here, because they are flying down from, or flying back to Canada. All right, here's one. We've talked about mosquitoes, some of the crap that they're doing with genetically modified mosquitoes. We did that back probably 4 or 5 weeks ago, looked at some of that, and how they have already released them in, it was northeast Australia, I believe, for the equine. There was some sort of equine disease that mosquitoes were spreading. They also let them go in, was it Cayman? Was one, or Jamaica was one of those countries in the Caribbean. They let some genetically modified mosquitoes go, and now they're talking about letting them go in the Keys to fight Chickamauga virus. Well, check this out. Science.sciencemag.org. Science. This is another trade mag. Came out with a story the other day. And this is the type of stuff that scares me, because when we dug into the biological weapons history for the United States, we discovered that day when we did that show, the biological weapons program in the United States was ended in 69, I believe, Wikipedia said. And in like 72, 73, Nixon had inked it, where our biological weapons program was going to be a defensive one, right? And pretty much biological weapons are banned around the world, but ours is going to be a defensive one. And the way that we're going to defend against biological weapons is the creation of vaccines. That's when our biological weapons program went underground. And one of the things that they were experimenting with before it went underground was utilizing mosquitoes as a biological delivery device for biological weapons. We've also heard about Plum Island. We did a show on that too. That was actually right around that time. We've talked before in the past about the mosquitoes up in Thousand Islands, Lyme's disease, a bunch of other things. So this isn't surprising to me, but it scares me when I see that they're doing more research now on mosquitoes. And this one happens to be a quote-unquote chain reaction that spreads genes throughout insects. Now, things that they do to insects, they also then find a way to somehow get into us in the future. You know, I mean, here's one thing that worries me is, like, when you're looking at GMO crops and we're watching some of the inhibitors, or not even GMO crops, like, let's go to some of the pesticides for, like, flea control. You know, some of those flea control products that you put on your animals, the way they work is they render the flea barren. So the flea can't reproduce. the eggs, and actually those Oxitec mosquitoes that they wanted to release in the Keys, that's exactly what they did. They made them so even if they tried to reproduce, the eggs weren't fertile. And so there couldn't be another generation of, you know, living organism. And that's what happens with the flea control as well. And what worries me, you know, and then they're messing with all this stuff in our food and, you know, cutting the pesticide genes into the corn and whatever. Here's the thing. How does that affect the organisms that at the end of the food chain, like us, end up consuming that? And I mean, they, with some of the, and I mean, they have different causes or whatever, but all I'm saying is that hacking genes and hacking biology and expecting there not to be consequences is very naive and dumb on our part. And the FDA just rubber stamping this stuff, like the, again, with the apples. Oh, an apple's an apple. Doesn't matter if it's genetically modified because it's still an apple. Rubber stamp it. Yeah. You know, this, it's naive if they want to put their heads in the sand and pretend like there couldn't possibly be any issues. It's borderlining nefarious or even beyond nefarious if they're rubber stamping this while knowing that there's going to be consequences and just sitting back now making sure we get an electronic health records database so we can all be bagged and tagged so they can watch what happens to our health when we consume these products. All right, let's read this anyway. Chain reaction spreads gene through insects. Oh, lucky them. Hopefully we're next. On December 28th, 2014, Valentino Gantz and Ethan Beer checked on the fruit flies that had just hatched in their lab at the University of California, San Diego. And by the classic rules of Mendelian genetics, only one out of four of the newborn flies should have shown the effects of the mutation their mothers carried, an X-linked recessive trait that caused a loss of pigmentation similar to albinism or albinoism. That's what I always thought it was called, but it's albinism. Instead, nothing but pale yellow flies kept emerging. We were stunned, said Beer, who is a Gantz PhD advisor. It was like the sun rose in the west rather than in the east. They hammered out a paper and submitted it to Science 3 days later. And in the study published online this week, Gantz and Beer reported that the introduced mutation disabled both normal copies of a pigmentation gene on the fruit fly chromosome, transmitting itself to the next generation with a 97% efficiency, a near complete invasion of the genome. Do you like that wording? A near complete invasion of the genome. Now, I'm going to tell you what, not reading any more of this story, I'm going to tell you that these two boys at UC San Diego, under the guise of Manette Napolitano, remember, she's president down now in the University of California educational system. These two boys, Valentino and Ethan, are probably going to get a big fat check to continue the research from places such as DARPA. I'm just saying. I don't know that for sure, but I'll bet you if they've found a way for a near complete invasion of the genome, somebody's going to want to take a big look at that. The secret of its success, an increasingly popular gene editing toolkit called CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R is the acronym, which Gantz and Bear adapted to give the mutation an overwhelming advantage. The technique is the latest, and some say the most impressive example of gene drive, biasing inheritance to spread a gene rapidly through a population or even an entire species. I mean, this is like absolutely hijacking evolution. This is getting a gene that wouldn't maybe have normally become the dominant gene to become the dominant gene and spread everywhere. At this level of efficiency, a single mosquito equipped with a parasite-blocking gene could, in theory, spread malaria resistance through an entire breeding population in just a single season. Now, that should be frightening. I mean, yeah, it's great. Okay, so let's in one season breed out the ability to carry pathogens in mosquitoes. Yay! Until next year, it's breeding out anyone with intelligence in the human race for the next generation. I mean, the understanding of all of the science and cracking this code is allowing them to become literally gods. Like, they're going to be able to decide who lives and who dies, who breeds and who doesn't, what traits exist, and which pinkies and little toes get to go the way of the dinosaur. You know what I mean? I mean, this is not rinky-dink stuff. We are talking about manipulating biology to the point where you've turned it now into your own little toy box. I mean, this is Isle of Dr. Moreau to the nth degree. This paper comes out amid intense soul searching among gene drive researchers, with calls for public dialogue and self-policing for the technology. And remember, I told you guys way in the beginning, there are no laws. There are no ethics boards. There is no grand poobah that's in there going, tisk-tisk. We don't use three genes to make a baby. IVF therapy, which they're doing in Europe. What do you think of that? Using three genes, make a three gene baby to get around genetic anomalies from the other two parents. I mean, again, great. It's wonderful if you wouldn't be able to have a child who had a normal chance at life because you had some genetic anomaly that might very well be passed on to your child. So you could use a third normal, healthy egg. Or I don't even know. I didn't look deep enough into how they're doing IVF with three donors, but it's either an egg or a sperm cell. And they go in there and then they take genetic material and from the healthy one, mix it all up, shake it up in the test tube. I don't know, however they do it, but I mean it's just unnatural. The point of the matter is they are taking what nature has been able to do beautifully and orchestrate for eons, for millennia. And we're messing with that. We're messing with that. It's like life has become a toy. And life has become a toy. There's no respect for it anymore. We see people blown up on TV every day. Hey, what's wrong with that? Oh, well, we laugh about it. Cover your head, it comes with flying body parts. I mean, there is not any respect for life anymore. And the fact that they are just mixing things, I mean, the next thing we're going to see, and we'll read about this, actually, scientists around the world are standing up right now going, hey, Chuck, maybe we should at least put it into neutral and get off the hill. So I got to give them that bonus. But I mean, it's not just me that's sitting here ranting like a lunatic as to the horrifying consequences that are right through that door that they're knocking on pretty hard. Sorry, let's read a little bit more. This paper comes amid intense soul searching among gene drive researchers with calls for public dialogue and self-policing for the technology. George Church, a geneticist at Harvard Medical School in Boston, who is a leader in the field, believes the new study should not have been published because it does not include measures to restrain the spread of unintended mutations. This is a step too far, he said. And absolutely, when I saw that they have been able to create a chain reaction gene that goes through an entire population, I was like, no. I mean, that's a weapon right there. In this case, with the mosquitoes or the fruit flies or whatever they're using, they're like, oh, yeah, well, we can get rid of them being able to carry disease. It's great. But I mean, tomorrow, what would it be? They could spread a gene through a population that makes you a bioweapon. You know, you could become Typhoid Mary and not even know it. And I mean, maybe not people, maybe fruit flies that, you know, reproduce in less than a week. I think it's like 3 days or something. They have a whole life cycle. And then set them loose in a population into a major city center or something. Hey, in 3 days they'll be gone. There's all the evidence gone. And everybody's dead. I mean, it's just, this is not cool. It's not cool at all. And the implications, I can absolutely see why he said that this publishing this data is a step too far. But remember, too, this brings up another great question that we looked at in regards to the bird flu, the 1918 flu epidemic, when they've been publishing these scientific articles now showing how they could make these pathogens much more virulent, or, you know, MSM coming out going, oh, radicalization on the internet. We shouldn't allow there to be information on how to make, you know, on things you could do with pressure cookers. And I mean, when this again is that double-edged sword that's all over the place. I mean, there's lots of double-edged swords don't get cut. You know, if we start calling for limiting the information that's being allowed to be published online, let's say, or limiting our us, the uneducated, as compared to these Harvard geneticists, let's say. You know, restricting our access to information like this. I for one, if I read the whole like how-to on this, it probably wouldn't mean much to me. So it doesn't matter. But what I like to do is to read the technical article to garner the information that I can understand out of it, or to find stuff that I can dig into and then research. But it's a slippery slope to start saying that we should restrict information that is available. I think they're going to do it too. Internet 2.0, don't forget, FCC takeover, national security. It's all a part of that. Okay, let's get back here. Creating a gene drive system wasn't Gantz's original goal, Bear says. We were just trying to solve a practical problem. Gantz studies the development of fruit fly wing veins, for which he must create flies with multiple mutations. That typical work is painstaking, requiring large numbers of flies over many generations to create a single multi-mutant. I'm sure we'll be seeing that in the future. Multi-mutants. Mutants with multiple mutations, I'm assuming. Last summer, Gantz made a tweak to the CISPR system in which an engineered bacterial protein, CAS9, uses a string of RNA to find and delete, replace, or otherwise edit a target DNA sequence. Holy shit! This is what we've been talking about. All these new drugs, the RNAi guys, that's what I'm telling you. That's what they're doing with RNAi. That's what RNAi does. It allows it to get into your system and to go in and edit your DNA. Wow. So this would not take a generation of humans to make this change. This would take a group of humans getting injected with a string of RNA, some sort of RNAi interference, RNA interference. They can go in and make changes to your DNA sequencing. By equipping the CISPR gene cassette with DNA sequences flanking the targeted gene, Gantz hoped to create a mutation that would auto-catalyze. Once incorporated in one chromosome, it would produce new copies of the CISPR complex that would target and edit the gene everywhere it appeared. And you know, after we listen to Kurzweil and Fuentes, it was pretty apparent that those were some of the things that they were looking at doing with nanobots as well, is you know, letting them go in and scan every cell, and they could let out the payload. All you got to do is load one of those suckers up with some good RNA strings to go edit your DNA, and there you go. That's actually kind of how it works in the Gardasil vaccine with those virus-like particles. Beer realized that Gantz self-replicating gene cassette could cause gene drive. These are self-replicating too. Isn't that what Freitas said? It was the one thing he was against. After discussions with UC San Diego, the university gave the experiment the green light if certain biosafety measures were taken. The flies are kept in three layers of tubes and boxes, and the lab is locked behind five doors with fingerprint security. I mean, that's some pretty heavy-duty security. I'm telling you, they're going to pick up these guys for biowarfare research. Gantz and Bayer knew they had achieved the first goal, making double mutants in one step on December 18th of last year when a yellow female fly developed from embryos injected with CRISPR cassette targeting the X chromosome pigmentation gene, but they wanted to know whether the engineered gene could make it through the germ cells and invade the next generation. The yellow flies they saw on December 28th confirmed that it did with 97% efficiency. Guys, they wouldn't even have to be a pathogen that would be introduced into a population this way. This could literally be like some sort of RNA strand that goes in and, I don't know, flips off our ability to digest proteins or flips off our ability to produce white blood cells. Think about that. Listen to this. The technique is, quote, fantastic, unquote, says geneticist Anthony James of UC Irvine, whose lab made the first transgenic mosquitoes nearly two decades ago with a far more laborious technique. Bears and James are already collaborating to create mosquitoes equipped with genes designed to block the transmission of malaria and dengue fever and to quickly spread through the population. Oh, I'm sure Bill Gates is creaming himself on this one. I'm sure he wants in. Actually, these genetically modified mosquitoes, if this actually works, they're not going to need the vaccines now, are they? Or the Oxitec mosquitoes. This is not the only horse in the gene drive race. Church's group also has a CRISPR approach that works at near perfect efficiency in yeast. Yeast is another one of those organisms that reproduces quickly that they can do a lot of genetic research in, and their code is very similar to humans, if you can believe it. It includes built-in precautions designed to prevent the system from running amok. Well, phew. For example, Church avoids incorporating CAS9's gene and the targeting RNA sequence into a single cassette so that unintended genes cannot become accidentally incorporated and spread. Because Gantz and Beer's method does not have such safeguards, it encourages a standard behavior that is much lower than what we are recommending. So they're basically saying that those guys are using a method that's like a hack that could have really nasty consequences. What will spread is not literally their mutant flies, but their protocol. Beer rejects the criticism. Quote, the safeguards that Church is using in the yeast just can't work well in flies, he notes. I bristle when people say that we haven't thought about this carefully. Adds James, who last year co-authored a World Health Organization report on precautions for use of transgenic mosquitoes. And how could we not publish this work? Nothing is served by hiding things. The whole point is to show that it is possible and to have a public discussion. Sure, I think the public discussion needs to be stop all this insanity. And let's take a look at what the end result of hacking biology is going to be at some point. I want to find the other story here. Oh, there was one about... So here we go, editing the genome. Scientists are calling for a ban on editing the human genome. This is out of RT a couple days back. A group of leading scientists have called for a worldwide boycott on a new technique for editing genomes that result in DNA being altered in a way that can be inherited by future generations. And this is the same technique, it's sounding like to me. While the technique has many benefits, such as curing genetic diseases, it also can be used to enhance qualities like beauty or intelligence, something that ethicists believe should not be done. The biologists are also concerned that the technique is so easy to use that doctors may push ahead with it before it is clinically safe to do so, they said in a paper on the subject, which was published in the journal Science. You could exert control over human heredity with this technique, and that is why we are raising the issue, said David Baltimore, former president of the California Institute of Technology, who is one of the scientists behind the paper. Remember, the former head of Department of Homeland Security, Janet Napolitano, is the president of the state university system in California. And don't think that you don't have mad science gone mad down there. Lawrence Livermore is down there. You got lots of DARPA work going on. So I'm sure that they're just loving this. Biologists say that they want to continue laboratory research on the technique, which is nowhere near ready for clinical use. Quote, this raises the most fundamental of all issues about how we are going to view our humanity in the future and whether or not we are going to take the dramatic step of modifying our own germline, in a sense, and take control of our genetic destiny, which raises enormous perils for humanity, says George Q. Daly, a stem cell expert at Boston Children's Hospital, and another member of the group, as quoted by the New York Times. In 1975, when gene science and medicine were in its infancy, scientists worldwide agreed not to manipulate genes using the so-called recombinant DNA technique. Quote, we asked at that time that nobody do certain experiments, and in fact, no one did, to my knowledge, which exactly, that's it. You know, we found out that there's been some crazy stuff quite a number of years back being done in UK labs with human-animal chimeras that nobody knew about either, but it doesn't mean it's not happening. It says, so there is a moral authority that you can assert from the U.S., and that's what we hope to do. Yeah, the moral authority, which is some loosely based group of scientists going tisk tisk, says Dr. Baltimore, who is the member of the 1975 group. But while such techniques are tightly regulated in the U.S. and Europe, the biologists are concerned about countries where regulation is more lax. I'd like to know where these tight regulations are. There's nothing that I've seen in writing that says that there is any type of tight purse strings on any of this, and especially where the black hole money comes from that's working on a lot of this stuff in the name of national security. How can you, I don't believe it for 1 second that they are not crossing moral lines in some labs 22 floors down under the ground in the deserts of Nevada or New Mexico somewhere. I mean, come on, you could never convince me of that. Through this new method of recombinant DNA editing is known as the acronym CRISPR-Cas9. So this is the exact same process that we were just reading about in the other story. And although highly efficient, there is a risk that the genome can be cut at unintended sites. And this issue is something that Jennifer Doudna, who invented the gene editing approach, wants to see thoroughly researched before anything is done to a human. Phew! So far, the technique has been successfully used in rats, mice, and monkeys, though. Don't worry about people making changes without their knowledge of what those changes mean in terms of the overall genome. I personally think that we are just not smart enough. Didn't I say that? Because we're not. And we won't be for a very long time to feel comfortable about the consequences of changing heredity, even in a single individual. In February, the British Parliament passed the transfer of mitochondria, the small DNA-containing organelles, to human eggs. But this technique is far less reaching than gene editing, and that's exactly what I was talking about. That's the three-person babies that have been approved. The UK became the first country to legalize three-person babies on February 3rd, where DNA is from two women. Yeah, so two eggs and one man. Critics say the technique raised too many ethical and safety concerns, but proponents say it was, quote-unquote, good news for progressive medicine. Damn the progressives. They're the ones creating the problem. All right. So if you can even believe it, we have reached the end of the show, and I didn't even get into some of the stories about psychopathy that I came across this morning, but we will look at those tomorrow, I guess. I wanted to play a video clip, but I don't even have anything queued up, so that kind of bites. But it's Monday, guys, so hey, that's the way it goes. What we'll do is, here, we'll listen to this for a second, if I can get there. Uh-oh. Mondays are so hard for me.
Okay. Introduced in 1959, and despite its old age, it's a toy that's remained eerily relevant. Many people attribute that to the fact that it constantly changes, often incorporating new tech.
Let's go ahead.
Fair recently gave a demonstration of that interaction. Take a look.
Well, we are on stage to show all these lovely people how amazing you are, Barbie.
Being on stage is exciting, isn't it?
Yes, I love it.
This is the AI-ish Barbie that will talk to you, respond to the things you say, records your conversations, and can email your conversations to parents. This is a pretty frightening thought. You're going to have spy Barbies in your little girl's room. All right, guys. Time is up here. We got about 40 seconds left. Make sure everyone sticks around because, of course, it's Monday. I'm going to have to see if I can even remember my own schedule because everything is locked up here. We have Josh. No, we don't have Josh. It's Monday. Josh doesn't do Mondays. Actually, Mondays now at 6, we have the Ocelli Effect Rewind, where Chuck has given me a whole bunch of shows to play in there. Good interviews. Michael Cross's replay from this week. At 8 p.m. Eastern, brand new Truth on the Tracks with Brandon at 9, United Front Radio with Danielle and Kyle at 10, and then Anti-Media Radio with Nick and DB live at 11. So, all right, guys, everyone have an awesome Monday. We'll be back tomorrow. Tomorrow, we are digging into psychopathy and new drugs they've discovered to make you more compassionate when you lack empathy as a psychopath. So how awesome is that? All right, guys, everyone, try to have a good Monday, and we will catch up with you tomorrow.